Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
I lift children into the scales, stooping to put their shoes back on afterwards so they don't get their socks dirty in the dust. I've been reading a lot recently about structural macroeconomic adjustment and the World Bank's most recent report explaining why the Mexican economy isn't behaving the way they predicted it would when the free trade agreement was first introduced. The problem, self-evidently, seems to lie in trying to pay off the $13.6 billion trade deficit. Latest reports, though, show that the free market restructuring, analysed in 1994, seems to be actually increasing poverty rather than alleviating it. Well, say the economic experts, those figures are no doubt due to the substitution of foreign goods for domestically produced goods. I'm sure I'm not the only one who's under the impression that this dismantling of trade barriers was one of the very principles of the NAFTA agreement itself. Oh, that's just a market distortion, they're saying now. Sure, there's a hard decade or two at the beginning, but then the economic benefits of free trade and global deregulation will come pouring in. The mothers watch the scales, measuring their children's health with tightly drawn faces. They nod and hug their children as we give out the amaranth supplements, explaining their preparation, how it's better to mix them with milk rather than water. As I lift the kids in and out of the scales and note their weights on graphs, I know that they're better economic indicators than any figures on paper, and I trust that evidence in front of my eyes a lot more than I trust a blueprint on a big teak desk in a distant office in Washington. They're too thin. Their fathers aren't around. Their mothers save 30 cents a week. It would take a lot of jiggery-pokery to convince me that these children, born into automatic debt which they will never repay, no matter how hard they work or for how little, aren't at the bottom of this particular heap. I read all the glossy reports and policy statements, and as far as I can see, here's the economic logic. Make it untenable for agrarian workers, who used to grow enough food for national self-sufficiency, to stay on the land. Then the US can subsidise its farmers to grow corn and beans, Mexico's staple crops, and haul them over the border in the interests of free trade and deregulation to undercut the going rate. Small farmers clinging onto their land by the barest margin can't compete with the subsidised imports and go under. Absorb them into the growing industrial and service sectors and then, with agro-industrial export earnings, purchase the country's food that people used to grow themselves. Only now, there'll be a dependent workforce who needs to buy its food to survive and who'll be willing to agree to almost any conditions the companies might impose, because if you're hungry enough, you'll agree to anything. So people will work for less and less per hour, in toxic waste, in cement-floored sheds, in the blazing sun, in atrocious conditions. They will queue as casual day labourers for a minimum salary of about 30 pesos a day, around $3 US. De-stoning, ploughing and picking for 10 hours. It's better, surely, to go to the factories or over the border or somewhere, anywhere, where you can provide for your family. This is where the men are now. Why? Well, that's the way the world is now. It's structural adjustment, the macroeconomic system. The bosses, the dueños, the jefes, the experts know best. If only we could supply roof guttering and water tanks to these houses to conserve the rainwater every year. If only we could get hold of a shipment of second-hand sewing machines so that women could make their own clothes. If only people in Australia could send over some salvage roofing iron, say, or chimney flues, so that we could build smokeless stoves. Then women wouldn't have to walk miles each day to chop down trees for firewood to cook their food and sterilise their water. And kids wouldn't get chronic eye infections from the open cooking fires smoking in the corners of people's kitchens. If only I knew the right channel so I could lobby the embassy or Rotary International or some philanthropic foundation to ship over here the kinds of things you find at the op shop and the tip in Australia. If only. I falter in my perseverance when they don't write back to me or give me a polite brush off. I can't penetrate the political payola system which implacably keeps things the way they are. I lack the will to be what people need here, someone with a few contacts who doesn't mind being seen as a pushy nuisance. With everything that has been invested in me, I still can't change a thing. My contribution here seems infinitesimal, laughable. I lack the imagination to see how to make any real impact. Energy has been poured into me for years to prepare me to do something useful. I've always hated waste and mismanagement of resources, the energy crisis which has always seemed like someone else's fault, something that only required better redistribution and equity. But here, I can barely convert a fraction of my privilege into anything constructive. My uselessness is exposed, as flimsy and conditional as a stage set. If there's an energy crisis here, it's me. On the cusp of the Pope's visit here to Mexico, forever faithful, the Empire of Rome seems fonder than ever of citing how many Catholics there are in the world. 850 million it's been claiming of late. I go into churches all the time to test this hypothesis and attend every religious ritual I can. They're not hard to find here, obviously. The boom of fireworks at dawn will give it away. The bank up of traffic that reveals a procession is ahead or some pilgrimage is in progress. People who receive 5 working days holiday a year spend that time walking in the blazing sun to a shrine 200 kilometres away. They sleep in the fields at night and walk all day, singing and carrying devotional banners. I've been an honoured guest at many town fiestas where the same band was called back to play year after year because Our Lady loves that kind of music, just as she loves her annual jaunt around the streets, hoisted onto a float, strung with oranges, cookies, lollies and candles, with all the children dressed as Aztec kings dancing down the street in front of her. She loves the visit from the statue of Our Lady carried from another town 11 kilometres away, and because the two love to meet at dawn, this means the whole town will rise at 3:30 a.m. to carry her there, stopping every few hundred metres for a decade of the rosary. Witnessing these meetings in chilly dawn mist as shawl and poncho-wrapped peasants trudge up the cobbled road, carrying decorated statues towards each other singing, it's hard to believe you're at the cusp of the 21st century. The Reformation exploded over the issue of false gods, of idolatry, of blasphemy, but don't try telling that to these people as they raise their cheap-framed prints of the Virgin over their heads to capture the holiness of the cathedral's bell sound as it tolls down on them. Those prints go back into one-room houses and radiate sagradissimo, sacredness. Those prints cure cancer. You can buy soap which cures cancer as well, and amulets that help you win the lottery. You can put white powder from the curandera into your husband's shoes and he will never stray to another. Whole sections of the market are devoted to articles these pious Catholics need for worship. Black chickens to cure bad humours. Wax figures. Piles of tiny nickel milagritos. Shaped like sheep or guardian angels or arms and legs or eyes. Depending on what you're praying for. Relief from ailments or a lucky break. When your prayer is answered, you pin the milagrito to the robes of the saint's statue that you prayed to. The feet of these saints are worn away with kissing. Their velvet is threadbare with stroking. Behind them in glass cases are enormous mosaics of biblical scenes, 7 or 8 metres across, made entirely from hundreds of thousands of returned milagritos. We live in the north, where mainly mixed-blood mestizo Mexicans live their devout lives, growing up attending catechism class every Sunday after Mass, but still managing to hang bunches of herbs over the door, which they've picked at crossroads to give them greater potency. The members consecrate a new pig farm by inviting a priest to pray for success and shake bunches of flowers dipped in holy water over every stall. Every Sunday, there's something new on the biblical calendar, like Jesus' presentation in the temple, when children from all over the town dress as tiny Jewish scholars, right down to the charcoal beards and moustaches. Or the Ascension of Mary, where 3 young women parade up the streets to the cathedral dressed as various stages of the Virgin's life, young, old and dead in a big display case. But only dead bodily as was explained to me, because she had ascended. Yes, but wasn't the doctrinal teaching that Mary had actually ascended bodily? Isn't the celebration of the ascension about that very thing? Oh yes, but this moment is before she ascended. Like Snow White waiting for her prince, the young woman feigning death in the Perspex casket was carried past as onlookers all crossed themselves. The further south you travel in Mexico, the more indigenous the population becomes, and the more the religion becomes fused with something much older, much stranger, much more mysterious. The Benedictines and the Franciscans knew their stuff. They built churches on extant sacred sites, often destroying the temple or pyramid and rebuilding the church from the same stones. They focused on the soaring lions and columns, the fake gilt ceilings, plenty of lifelike imagery gesturing somberly from the walls, statues with real clothing and hair. To say Christianity sparked a chord in the Mayan and Aztec sensibility is like saying water sparks a chord in ducks. The concept of the resurrection, of a young sacrificed fear, they already had. The notion of hellish suffering they were soon to find out about. Indentured as unpaid mission slaves, dying like flies from smallpox, typhoid and the sword, it must have made sense to them that the Christ figure was crowned with thorns and writhing in agony. They've taken comfort in it ever since. This is life, says the Aztec Florentine Codex, a path of petals and a path of thorns. To tread that path to Catholic heaven, that road of pleasure and pain, may require some relinquishment of pagan beliefs, but not many. The Franciscans turned a blind eye for 450 years as worshippers brought bowls of corn gruel to church and laid them in front of the altar, muttering ancient pre-Hispanic prayers, or made crucifixes for the shrines deep in the forest where spring water signalled the presence of spirits. As long as the locals kept coming, it seems like they could interpret the good book in pretty much whatever way they liked. Having them at the mission meant an ongoing supply of a free labour force, diseased and depleted as they were, to enrich the Kingdom of Spain with silver, gems and natural resources. When they became troublesome, as they did in Cuba and off the Veracruz coast, they were quickly baptised and dispatched. Satan has now been expelled from the island. His influence has disappeared now that most of the Indians are dead, reported the zealous Spanish missionary and historian Oviedo in 1554, adding piously, "Who can deny that the use of gunpowder against pagans is the burning of incense to our Lord?" It says something about the ferocious power of passive resistance that Mexico's indigenous have managed to keep such a myriad of beliefs and traditions together. There's a stubborn refusal to assimilate, to be objectified, counted, vaccinated and herded. It drives the government crazy, this reticent and determined carrying on as always, this polite but firm no thanks. One of the most uplifting and resonant rituals I ever saw took place in a small village on the shores of Lake Atitlan in Guatemala. The requisite statue of St. Anthony, the personage the Catholic fathers had ensconced, was carried from the church to the piercing music of a thumping brass band who were all dressed splendidly in hot pink shirts. The town elders were in charge of the deafening fireworks and rockets to accompany the float. As the villagers carefully manoeuvred their saint up the street, I saw that he'd been dressed in indigenous clothing, a bright red skirt, a woven blue shirt, exactly like everybody present. They had prized his plaster Bible from his hand and replaced it triumphantly with an ear of corn. Holding his truly holy icon aloft, resplendent in local colours and surrounded by flowers and palm fronds and mirrors and peacock feathers, the plaster saint had been resurrected quietly and determinedly as something meaningful. The Catholic Church makes much nowadays of its sincere attempts to stay relevant in a world where it fears it's becoming redundant. If only it could see its relevance in action on Lake Atitlan. Memory fights against oblivion. The cedarwood smoke drifts heavenwards with their prayers. These rituals survive, battered and transformed, but with their true invisible shape somehow intact.
You've You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.